contributing to a loss of humanity, another might view as improving on humanity. Norma Senva, Kolhar Shipyard's internal memo. After the turmoil and nonsense of the recent Landsraad League meeting, Joseph Venport returned to the primary Venhold headquarters on Kolhar and continued to stew over what he had seen and heard. Manfred Tarondo and his barbarians wanted to seize the controls of the great ship of human civilization and crash it. Legless, half-Manfred was a bizarre spokesperson, but the odd man, along with Raina Butler before him and the revered Serena Butler preceding both of them, bore the mystique of martyrdom, which held a certain guilty attraction for some. In establishing and expanding Venport Holdings, Joseph and his predecessors strove to lay down a viable commercial network to raise the Imperium from the ashes after defeating Omnius. He wanted to lift humanity to the glorious heights they had been denied under the domination of thinking machines. The Butlerians, on the other hand, wanted to drag populations into a dark swamp of hardship and ignorance. He had firmly, perhaps naively, believed that the Butlerians' silliness would peter out in time, and he couldn't fathom how the movement had gained so much momentum. He considered it a personal affront. Logic and progress should automatically trump superstition. With all that on his mind, Joseph was in a surly mood when he returned home, but his wife Sioba and six advisors met him as he disembarked at the spaceport, and he felt a sense of stability returning. She was a bastion of organization. Sioba, with her rigorous sisterhood training, was a perfect match for him, helping to run the numerous components of Venport Holdings, both the public ones and the secret ones, like a well-choreographed dance. She was a striking woman, beautiful and intense, with prominent dark eyebrows, pale skin, and very long brunette hair that she kept pinned up under a practical scarf during the business day. But when she loosed the tresses and brushed them in the evening, they fell down below her waist. Joseph was not a romantic man, and he had approached the marriage from a business perspective, knowing that he had no plan for the future of the Venport line. Having one of their graduates marry into Venhold was an obvious boon for the Rossack School, due to Venport's wealth and political power, and the sisterhood had offered several candidates for him to consider. Sioba had scored highest when Joseph assessed his options. In the 12 years of their marriage, Sioba had been an incomparable partner in running the business. As the granddaughter of Carrie Marquis, she also had a hint of sorceress blood. Joseph traced his own lineage back to Rossack as well, through Norma Senva, whose mother, Zufa Senva, had been one of the most powerful sorceresses in history. Sioba's two young daughters with Joseph had enormous potential, according to the sisterhood bloodline analysis, and both had been sent off to Rossack to be raised and trained there. He walked forward from the shuttle, giving a formal greeting to his wife and the advisors. He did not kiss her, nor did she expect it. That would come later. They filled different roles now in public. She had her report ready and delivered a rapid-fire summary of urgent matters, crises she had already solved, other emergencies that required his intervention. What he appreciated most was that Sioba did not waste his time. She sorted out only the items that genuinely required his attention. She talked as he set the pace, always moving, and the advisors chimed in, adding necessary details and opinions. Although Joseph paid attention to the many Venhold operations and investments, he tried to remain above the nitty-gritty details, not unlike his great-grandmother Norma Senva, who remained in mental isolation, engrossed in her own concerns and barely able to communicate with mere humans like him. Returning here from Seleucia Secundus, he felt secure and stable, knowing that Venhold was in good hands, and he could forget the outside chaos for a while. Around him, the landing fields were a blur of movement, shuttles rising and landing, cargo pods dropping into place, refueling tankers racing up to docked vessels. Support workers, engineers, and designers filled cylindrical administrative complexes like drones in a hive. By the time he reached his office in the giant admin building, Sioba had finished delivering her summaries. Joseph turned to the advisors and dismissed them before closing the door so he could be alone with his wife. Both of them took seats, relaxing but still focused on business. "So which things are time critical?" he asked. "Exactly what needs my signature and what can wait until tomorrow?" "I believe the last thing I mentioned is the most time critical," Sioba said. "As we discussed before you left, I stepped up efforts to watch 3 more exiles from the CET. One of them was exposed by the mobs and killed. The other 2 renegades are ready to go to ground under the terms we proposed." "I have no patience for mobs." His face took on a pinched expression. "Although the CET delegates caused their own troubles, I'm willing to help protect them from the foolish religious hordes." The riots over the Orange Catholic Bible were only peripherally connected with the Butlerian movement, but they shared a similar basis in superstition and ignorance. Peasants bearing torches. Sioba said in an even voice, "Remember, the delegates were misguided fools, too. The whole commission of ecumenical translators, in fact. They started with the false premise that they could apply a single rational order to all of humanity's diverse and contradictory religious beliefs. No wonder people revolted against them." Joseph had established a hidden refuge on a near-forgotten planet, Tupoli, offering it as a sanctuary for anyone who wanted to vanish, including the reviled Ture Bamoko, who had fled there immediately after that unpleasant incident in the Imperial Palace with the wife of Emperor Jules Carino, and the subsequent bloodbath. Only the Spacing Fleet navigators knew how to reach that planet, so its location was completely secure. "Very well. Ship them off to Tupoli. No one will find them there. If you agree." "I agree, that would be best." Joseph signed the authorization document, then asked his wife to accompany him out to see Norma Senva in her tank. Under the cloudy Kohar sky, the broad paved field was crowded with sealed tanks. Insulated plas portholes were designed to allow external inspectors to peer inside rather than for the tank's inhabitants to look out. Workers with suspensor-levitated canisters moved from tank to tank, pumping in fresh melange gas. Inside the numerous individual tanks, embryonic navigators swam in dense brownish-orange clouds, their physical bodies languid while their thoughts stampeded down uncharted paths. Atop a mound that had been built and ornamented like an acropolis sat the largest and oldest chamber, the tank that held Norma Senva. Accompanied by Sioba, Joseph ascended the marble steps, feeling like a supplicant approaching an idol. His great-grandmother had been immersed in spice gas, never breathing fresh air, never emerging in more than 8 decades, while her thoughts traveled through an esoteric tapestry of mathematics and physics. By most measures, she was no longer human. Norma was freakishly intelligent, with an evolved body and an ever-expanding mind, and her need for spice was insatiable. The navigators, the Venhold spacing fleet, indeed the whole concept of Holtzmann shields and space-folding engines, would have been impossible without her incredible breakthroughs. "No one can tell what she's really thinking about," Joseph said to his wife, "but she's made it clear to me that she longs to add many more ships to the Venhold spacing fleet. I told her that tens of thousands of vessels would be necessary to adequately service all the planets in the Imperium." "Maybe she just wants more navigators," Sioba said, "more like herself." He smiled as he reached the top step. "She's creating navigators as quickly as she can. But for that, she requires extraordinary quantities of spice. I pointed out to her that the more ships we possess, the more melange we can transport around the Imperium, and thus the more navigators she can create. Everyone benefits." From the hill, they could see the busy spaceport and shipyards. Each hour, a newly refitted vessel lifted off. Launch towers were great spires in the sky, needles pointing toward the heavens. Simply keeping track of all the scheduled spacefaring flights that connected and serviced the Imperium's thousands of planets was an administrative nightmare, but Joseph had thousands of people to work on the task, all of them housed in a single building complex. Fortunately, not all of his ships required navigators. Slow haulers were adequate for transporting non-critical cargo from planet to planet on traditional routes, using old-style pre-Holtzmann engines. Even though the trip took months, it was less expensive and perfectly safe. Space folders could make the passage almost instantaneously, but for years they had flown blindly. The pilots had charted their courses and prayed that no hazards lay along the path. Currently, low-budget carriers like Celestial Transport still risked blind travel, usually without informing their hapless passengers of the dangers. Years ago, during Serena Butler's jihad, Aurelius Venport had provided space folders for the war effort on condition that only his company had the right to use the technology after the thinking machines were defeated. And yet, within 2 decades of the Battle of Corin, Emperor Jules had amended the agreement to allow competition. Joseph remained incensed that his family's risk and hard work had been brushed aside, but he had also changed with the new rules. Only Venhold knew the secret of creating and training navigators who could actually encompass the cosmos in their minds and envision safe pathways through fold space. Saturated with melange gas, floating in suspensor fields, the navigator candidates turned their thoughts inward to a landscape of surreal physics and mathematics. As their minds changed and expanded, their need for spice became insatiable, just as Joseph's need for more navigators was insatiable. Although Sioba could occasionally get through to her, talking about their common Rossac connections, Joseph was the only one who could regularly communicate with Norma. Originally her son Adrian Venport, one of the key figures in establishing the Venport commercial empire, had served as Norma's liaison with the outside world for many years. In his later days, when his body was failing, Adrian had finally let his mother convince him to go into a spice tank himself, where he hoped to transform into a similarly evolved creature. But Adrian was too old, and his body too inflexible, and he had drowned in the melange gas. Grieving and withdrawn, Norma Senva hadn't been close to another human in years, until Joseph had gotten through to her. Now he stood before her tank, addressed the speaker patch, then waited, knowing that it sometimes took minutes for her attention to shift so that she noticed him. When Norma finally replied from within the tank, her voice was ethereal, drifting, synthesized. He had no idea what her actual vocal cords sounded like now, or even if they still functioned. "Have you brought more ships?" she asked. Sometimes Norma was perfectly articulate and comprehensible, sometimes distant and obtuse. It all depended on how much attention she gave him. "We've had some successes and some setbacks."
"Need more ships, more navigators, more spies. The universe is waiting."
In response, he said, "We don't have navigators for all the vessels currently online. We need more navigators to guide the ships, to haul the spice, to create more navigators." Norma paused for a moment, pondering.
"I see the conundrum."
"And more volunteers to undergo the transformation," Sioba added.
That was the true bottleneck.
"Few are willing to pay the price."
"The reward is the entire universe," Norma said.
"If only it were that simple," Joseph said. She truly didn't understand. As more and more vessels were added to the Venport fleet, the greatest need was finding enough volunteers to attempt the navigator transformation, and having enough of them survive to serve aboard the new ships. Someday, Joseph hoped that all of the navigator candidates would be willing volunteers. As it was, he needed to work with the material he had available. He and Sioba had discussed the problem at length, and she had even presented the offer to Reverend Mother Raquella, but so far none of the sisters had volunteered to transform themselves. How did one induce an intelligent candidate to enclose himself in a small prison filled with toxic amounts of spice gas and undergo an extreme physical and mental transformation? It was a tough sell.
"I'm doing what I can," he said. "Please be patient."
"I am patient," Norma said. "I can wait forever."
She fell silent, pondering, then said,
"I am guiding these candidates through their mental exercises. They will be good navigators."
Her enlarged eyes and flattened features drifted close to the smeared porthole.
"For all the technology that drives our space folder ships, the fleet still depends upon a human brain."
Her thoughts wandered,
and Joseph thought he had lost her attention, but then Norma spoke up again.
Need more ships. Need more navigators. Need more spice. Therefore, we need more ships.
Although she understood seemingly impossible things, Norma didn't grasp the sprawling business interests that Joseph had established. Not surprisingly, she also no longer cared about the nuances of politics, which was why Joseph had to watch over her. He spoke up. There are many ships, former machine ships, that Venhold can refit as passenger and cargo vessels. Whole fleets drift abandoned in space, but it's a race to find the available ships before the Butlerians do. They destroy the robot craft whenever they find them. Vandals and terrorists in the name of their cause. His voice rose with anger.
Then stop them, Norma said. They should not destroy ships we need.
Even Emperor Salvador turns a blind eye when the fanatics destroy the ships, Cioba said. I think he's afraid of the Butlerians.
The Emperor should stop them.
Norma fell silent, drifting in her tank. Joseph sensed she was deeply troubled. Finally, in her alien voice, she said,
I shall ponder this.
Then she drifted back into the thickening cinnamon mist.
Whether you see mankind's future as light or dark depends upon how you filter the flow of data streaming back to you.
Norma Senva. Salvador Carina was not having a good day. In fact, he could not recall the last day he'd considered even acceptable. Much of that was his own fault, since his phobias were excessive compared to those of an average person, but the ruler of the vast Imperium was not an ordinary person. Everything about him was supposed to be larger than life. While the Emperor suffered for his concerns, he wished he could be as calm and even-keeled as his brother Roderick. Today, Salvador was plagued by an infernal, unrelenting headache. He desperately needed to find a reliable doctor, one who did not make him suspicious. No one could match the attentive Dr. Elo Bando, former head of the Souk Medical School, who had truly understood the Emperor's pains and worries, a medical expert who had offered so many beneficial, though expensive, treatments. If only the damned man hadn't committed suicide. Though the famed school had moved its new headquarters to Parmentier, their old school building remained nearby in Zimia. Salvador requested their best doctors to tend him, but they sent someone different for each of his ailments, each time he experienced a twinge or imagined a new dire physical problem. Doctor after doctor, and none of them could find anything wrong with him. Incompetence! Salvador still hadn't found a new doctor he liked, and this one, he couldn't even remember the man's name, seemed no better than the rest. He knew the guests would all be waiting in the banquet hall for the evening meal, but the Carino Emperor was not ready, and they would just have to be patient. He couldn't be expected to attend a tedious banquet with his head pounding his thoughts to distraction. In his dressing room, Salvador slumped back in a plush chair while the latest soup doctor leaned over him, humming an annoying tune as he affixed probe strips to the ruler's balding pate. The doctor's long reddish hair was secured in a silver ring at the shoulder. He read signals on his handheld monitor, and the tone of his humming changed.
That's quite a headache you have. A brilliant diagnosis, doctor. I don't need you to tell me that. Is it serious?
No need to be unduly concerned yet, though you do look rather thin and emaciated, sire. Your skin seems pale.
You're here to see about my headache, not my complexion.
When Salvador's father was 70, a Souk doctor had diagnosed him with a brain tumor, but Emperor Jules refused to submit to high-tech medical procedures. Although Roderick, ever the voice of reason, had urged their father to seek the best treatment, Emperor Jules publicly supported the anti-technology Butlerian movement and shunned sophisticated doctors. And he had died. Salvador did not want to make the same mistake.
Here, let's see how this works for you.
Still humming, the doctor adjusted the monitor, and Salvador felt massaging vibrations permeate his skull, as if his brain were immersed in a soothing liquid, like a Cymec brain in a preservation canister. Instantly, he began to feel better. The doctor smiled at his important patient's relieved expression. Is that an improvement?
It will have to be good enough for now. There's a banquet to attend.
Salvador had been through this before. The headache might recede for now, but the tide would return soon. The Emperor got up and left without thanking him. This doctor would be gone before long, like all the rest. As he suspected, the other dinner guests were already seated around the table, looking at their empty plates in anticipation of the first course. Salvador exchanged gazes with his brother and noted that Roderick's auburn-haired wife, Haditha, sat farther down the table, talking with the slender Empress Tabrina. Good. She would keep the troublesome Tabrina occupied. Despite the promise of tight security around the Emperor, some guests wore personal shields that shimmered faintly in the air. As was their custom, the entire royal family did as well, with the exception of Salvador's reclusive stepmother, Orena, who had a personal dislike for many aspects of technology. Down the table, Orena sat straight-backed, willowy and haughty, a woman of sharp edges rather than soft curves, although she had been considered a great beauty in her day. The people still called her the Virgin Empress, because Emperor Jules had made it clear that he never consummated his marriage to her. Chatty Anna, the younger half-sister of Salvador and Roderick, sat next to Orena. She and her stepmother had an oddly close relationship, often spending time together, sharing their secret thoughts. Anna Carino had short brown hair and a narrow face like the Emperor's. Her eyes were small and blue. Though 21, she seemed much younger, mentally and emotionally. Her mood swung like a pendulum on a storm-rocked boat, and she hadn't been entirely stable since suffering an emotional trauma as a child. But she was a Carino, the Emperor's royal sister, and her flaws were overlooked. Anna glared at Salvador as soon as he entered, her expression full of hurt and accusation. Knowing exactly why she was miffed, he sighed and felt his headache already coming back. Acting as her eldest brother and as the Emperor, Salvador had put an end to the girl's inappropriate romance with a palace chef, Hirondo Neff. For some months now, Anna had allowed no one but Neff to prepare and deliver her food, but Salvador's spies had discovered that the chef was delivering more than dinner to his sister. What had the girl been thinking? Entirely unfazed by the family drama that simmered beneath the surface of the social gathering, Roderick talked easily with Sister Dorothea, a lanky woman with a sensual feline face, one of the graduates who had come to court from the respectable school on Rossack. A few days earlier, during Manfred Tarondo's alarming demands in the Landsrod Hall, he had been surprised to discover that Dorothea sympathized with the Butlerians, unlike most of the sisters of Rossack. Thankfully, Roderick, with swift thinking as usual, had staged the bomb threat and disrupted the silly but dangerous vote. Salvador didn't like the anti-technology fanatics. They were so intense, single-minded zealots who caused a lot of trouble. But he could not ignore their ever-growing numbers, their fervor, and their potential for violence. He had to tolerate them, at least. Maybe Dorothea could act as a liaison, a buffer between himself and the charismatic leader. He certainly couldn't deny the benefits that Dorothea and the 10 sisters like her brought to the Imperial Court. The women who graduated from Rossack had extraordinary powers of observation and analysis, and Dorothea had indeed impressed him with her perceptiveness ever since she'd come to the palace. Maybe she could talk some sense into his little sister before Anna got herself into more embarrassing trouble. Struggling to feign an aura of glowing health, the Emperor arrived at the head of the table. His guests rose to their feet, even Anna, grudgingly, but not his overdressed stepmother, who claimed to suffer from severe pains in her joints. Salvador had learned to ignore Lady Orena's quirks and passive disrespect. She was his father's widow, after all, and deserved consideration for that, though in imperial matters she remained irrelevant. Since Jules's 3 children were all illegitimate, born from different mothers, and none of them from his actual wife, Salvador supposed the old woman's annoyance could be excused. He took his seat, and the other guests dutifully sat back down. Instantly, servants burst like spring-loaded projectiles from where they had been waiting in the wings. They served an appetizer in a flurry, a salad of blova shrimp and savory hepnuts, presented on star-shaped leaves of lettuce. An attendant took up his position to taste the emperor's food. Roderick, though, waved the man away and leaned over to take a bite from the salad on his brother's plate. "I'll take care of this." Salvador reached out in alarm to stop him, but it was too late. Roderick chewed and swallowed. "The salad is very good." The blonde, muscular man smiled, and everyone began to eat as he whispered to Salvador, "You're silly to worry so much about your food. It makes you look weak and frightened. You know I'd never let anything happen to you." With a sigh of exasperation, Salvador began eating. Yes, he did know that Roderick would give his life to protect him, would risk poison or throw himself in front of an assassin's projectile. Alas, Salvador knew that he wouldn't do the same were the circumstances reversed. Roderick was a better person in almost every way. Down the table, Empress Tabrina let out a loud laugh, and Haditha nodded, pleased by some amusing comment. Salvador looked wistfully at his brother's wife, not out of lust, but out of envy for their relationship. Roderick's marriage to Haditha was stable, happy, and had produced 4 well-behaved children, while Salvador's marriage to Tabrina was as loveless as it was childless. Without doubt, the Empress was a great beauty, but lurking under that lovely exterior was a disagreeable, demanding personality. Sabrina's wealthy mining family was a key supplier of strong, lightweight construction materials that were vitally needed for government projects, and Salvador had signed an agreement guaranteeing dire financial repercussions if the Emperor ever divorced her. There were even severe contractual penalties in the event of her premature death. Salvador had no way out now. It was a lousy contract and a lousy marriage. Fortunately, he had 8 concubines. Not so many for a man of his position, and his father had certainly had plenty of lovers besides Empress Orenna. Tabrina might not approve, but it was established tradition, providing the rulers with other options than a loveless bed. The other diners conversed in low tones, occasionally glancing in his direction. They were waiting for him to establish the subject of conversation, which he customarily did. His headache was already coming back. Roderick noted the cue and took the lead to put his brother at ease. As they waited for the soup course, he raised a glass of white wine to the woman from Rossack. "Sister Dorothea, your school is mysterious, but quite impressive. Perhaps you can share some of your learning with us." "And perhaps not." Her brown feline eyes sparkled. "If we told our secrets, what need would there be for the sisterhood?" Chuckles circled the table. Roderick tipped his glass to her, conceding the point, and the discussion turned to the merits of the plethora of schools that had arisen since the end of the jihad. "We are living in very exciting times, a renaissance of learning. So many schools specializing in the potential of the human mind and body." Dorothea agreed. "It is imperative that humans see how far we can advance without oppression of thinking machines." The Emperor received regular reports from across his vast realm. Schools were springing up like weeds around the Imperium, each one with a particular specialization, a focus on various mental or physical disciplines. The Emperor could not keep track of all the philosophies, although he assigned functionaries to monitor them. In addition to the Sisters of Rossack and the Soup Doctors, Mentats were being taught on Lampadus, and adept swordmasters continued to emerge from Ganaz. He had also just learned of a well-financed new Academy of Physiology on Irawak that included studies of kinesthesiology, anatomical functions, and nervous systems. And there were literally hundreds of other crackpot disciplines. Educational cults, he considered them. Salvador took every opportunity to show public appreciation for his brother. "Roderick, unlike me, you are a fine physical specimen. Perhaps you could be an instructor at the new Physiology Academy, or even a recruiter." Roderick laughed and addressed Dorothea while all the diners listened. "My brother doesn't mean it. I have too many important governmental duties." "Quite true," Salvador said with not so feigned embarrassment. "Too often he needs to clean up after my mistakes." Nervous laughter. Roderick made a dismissive gesture, continuing to focus on Dorothea. "An And your advice has been invaluable as well, sister. Finally, servants began laying out the soup course. As women complete their training, Reverend Mother Raquella sends the majority of our graduates out to assist noble families in the Landsrod League. We think the sisterhood has much to offer. As for my own skills, I am particularly adept at determining truth from falsehood. She smiled at the two Carino men. Such as when one brother is lovingly teasing another. My family relationships are not so playful or loving, Anna blurted out, causing a hush to fall. In fact, Salvador doesn't know much about love at all. He has no love in his own marriage, so he's determined to deny me a chance at romance. The young woman sniffed, obviously expecting a show of commiseration from her companions. Lady Orena gave the girl a sympathetic pat on the shoulder. Empress Tabrina wore a completely stony expression. Anna sat straighter, her eyes flashing at Salvador. My brother shouldn't order me around in my personal life. No, but an emperor can. Sister Dorothea's crisp voice filled the shocked lull at the table. Good response, Salvador thought. Now how to get Anna out of here gracefully? He exchanged glances with Roderick, and his brother rose to his feet. Lady Orena, would you be so kind as to take our sister back to her rooms? Anna remained petulant. Refusing to look at her stepmother or at Roderick, she kept her eyes focused on Salvador. Separating me from Hironda will not prevent us from loving each other. I'll find out where you sent him, and I'll go there. Not tonight, though, Roderick said calmly, and motioned to his stepmother again. After a brief hesitation, Orena straightened from her chair, displaying the excellent posture of her station. Salvador noted that the older woman showed no apparent pain in her joints now as she took Anna's arm. The younger woman acquiesced at her touch, and the two departed the banquet hall with exaggerated dignity. One guest dropped a silver fork on a charger plate with a loud clatter in the awkward silence. Salvador wondered how he was going to salvage the evening and hoped Roderick might say something clever to lighten the mood. Anna was proving to be an unruly embarrassment. Maybe she would have to be sent away somewhere. Just then the air popped in the hall and a large armored chamber materialized in the open area that was occasionally used by court musicians. A rush of wind swirled around the banquet table. Diners scrambled away, and palace guards ran forward in alarm, surrounding the emperor to protect him. Automatically, he activated his personal shield. Through clear plaza windows in the tank, Salvador saw orange gas and the shadowy silhouette of a mutated creature with an oversized head. He recognized the figure immediately, though she was rarely seen in public anymore. Over many decades, Norma Senva had evolved into a form that no longer looked human. Ignoring the uproar among the diners in the hall, Salvador stood and faced the tank. At least it wasn't the drama of his little sister's romantic indiscretions. This is a most unorthodox visit. Silence fell in the hall as Norma's eerie voice emanated through speakers, as if from far across space. I no longer require a spacefaring vessel. I can now fold space with my mind. She sounded fascinated by the very idea. The spice gas in her tank became agitated, making a storm of swirls. Salvador cleared his throat. He had spoken with this mysterious woman only twice in the 12 years of his reign. She awed and intimidated him, but to his knowledge she had never harmed anyone with her extraordinary powers. You are welcome in my court, Norma Senva. Your contributions to our victory over the thinking machines are immeasurable. But why have you come here tonight? It must be something very important. I no longer relate to others. Bear with me as I attempt to express myself. Her large midnight eyes stared through the tank at Salvador, sending a chill of fear down his spine. I see parts of the future. And I am concerned. She drifted in her tank, and Salvador remained silent and tense, waiting for her to continue. To bind the Imperium, we must have a network of transportation and commerce. And for that, we must have starships. Salvador cleared his throat.
Yes, of course. We have the Venhold Spacing Fleet, Celestial Transport, and countless other enterprises.
Everyone remained hushed in the banquet hall. Then Norma said,
Thousands of machine vessels were abandoned in space. They are still intact. Those ships can be used for commerce, for civilization. But other groups destroy these vessels wherever they are found. Mobs cause great harm. I am very disturbed by this.
Salvador's throat went dry.
The Butlerians.
Manfred Tarondo took pride in sending reports to enumerate the machine ships that his people ransacked and exploded.
They act on their convictions. Some would call their fervor admirable.
They destroy valuable resources that could be used to strengthen human civilization. You must stop them.
The rusty swirls of gas cleared away, revealing Norma with all of the hideous, deformed details of her body, the stunted torso, the tiny hands and feet, the grossly large head and eyes, the nearly invisible mouth, nose, and ears.
Or your Imperium will fragment and die.
Salvador was left entirely without a response. He had no idea how he could stamp out the Butlerian movement, even if he wanted to. Before he could come up with excuses, however, Norma Sinva folded space, and her tank vanished from the banquet hall, leaving only a pop of displaced air. Emperor Salvador shook his head and muttered with forced levity,
Amazing what those navigators can do.
A quiet observer may learn countless secrets, but I prefer to be an active participant.
Erasmus, Secret Laboratory Notebooks. In order to keep his thoughts and memories in precise, accessible order, Amentat required a certain amount of meditation and mental practice every day, uninterrupted hours of quiet contemplation. As the headmaster of the school, Gilbertus Albans kept his office private, an isolated sanctuary where he could wall himself off and focus on improving his mind. Students, fellow instructors, and school administrators knew not to disturb him when he was inside his sealed office chamber. No one guessed what he was really doing there. The Erasmus memory core sat exposed on its stand, completely engaged in the conversation. When Gilbertus paced around the office, the independent robot spoke up.
Do you realize you taunt me just by moving about, flaunting your freedom by pacing back and forth?
Gilbertus took a seat at his desk, pushed a wisp of hair out of his eyes.
I'm sorry. I'll stay seated.
Erasmus chuckled.
You realize that does nothing to solve the problem.
And yet, it keeps you alive.
You must accept certain sacrifices and limitations in order to continue to exist. I saved you from Corin, and I appreciate that, but you speak of 80 years ago.
Gilbertus enjoyed sparring and debating with his old mentor.
Weren't you the one to tell me that machines have infinite patience?
True, but I was not made to be a passive observer. I have too many experiments to perform, too much to learn about the intriguing inconsistencies in human behavior.
I understand your predicament, Father, but you will have to content yourself with studying the material I provide, until we find some other solution.
I can't stay here forever. Gilbertus had already reached the limit where casual observers had begun to wonder about his perfect health, how he seemed quite young for his years, though he altered his appearance to look older. In order to keep secret the life extension treatment he'd received from Erasmus, Gilbertus had fostered the rumor that he consumed melange regularly, and the geriatric properties of spice gave him a youth and vigor beyond his years. Although he kept records of his spice purchases, he never consumed the substance. The last thing Gilbertus Albans needed was something to make him look even younger. The robot spoke up again.
If I am to be a scholar, then I must study human interactions. Despite this frustrating isolation, I have been able to tap into the school's power conduits and ventilation systems. With the materials at hand,
I created distant optic fibers, tiny remote spy eyes, so I can watch the day-to-day activities of your school. It is fascinating. If your spy eyes are discovered, the Butlerians might burn down the school. Illogical, but interesting, Erasmus said. I will trust your conclusion after my experiences with provocative and shockingly unpredictable human behavior. From his desk, Gilbertus withdrew a printed document that had been submitted for the library at the Mentat School. I have obtained a new history released by the Butlerians, which focuses on destroying your reputation. Another one? See the title. The Tyranny of the Demon Robot Erasmus. He raised the book, and the optic threads implanted in the room's walls and ceiling drank in the cover of the tome. Erasmus chuckled again. That does not sound objective. I thought you enjoyed the propaganda aspects of historical accounts. It always amuses me how a person with no first-hand knowledge of events can distort the facts with such vehemence. When I read Agamemnon's memoirs, I saw how the Cymec general distorted history. It took me a long time to discover that humans do not appreciate or even want the truth. Machines, on the other hand, would be at a great disadvantage if they knowingly used false data to draw their conclusions. Gilbertus let out a bright laugh. I think you enjoy being so reviled. The robot pondered this. I was hated for many centuries by my labor crews, my household slaves. Even Serena Butler despised me, and she was one of my favorite humans of all time. You, Gilbertus, are the only one who has ever seen my true worth. And even I am still learning, Gilbertus replied. In fact, he had read the histories himself and knew from his own observations that the robot had indeed committed most of the horrors attributed to him. Erasmus sounded impatient. Open the book. I want to read what the Butlerians say about me. Gilbertus dutifully turned page after page so that Erasmus could scan and absorb the words. Ah, I was not aware that the Butlerians had access to my laboratory notebooks. One of the volumes was recovered from Corin after the battle. I'm so glad the records were preserved, although I am disturbed that this author, and presumably the readers of this volume, could draw such ridiculous conclusions from my carefully researched data. I believe I understand more about human suffering than humans themselves do, Erasmus said. Gilbertus could imagine him shaking the smooth and beautiful flow metal head he used to have. However, if you would find a way to provide me with a sophisticated body again, I could continue my important work. You know that wouldn't be wise at this time. Although he loved the independent robot for all of the tremendous opportunities he'd given him, Gilbertus was wary and protective. Despite his mental acuity, Erasmus wasn't fully cognizant of the dangers he would face if ever he emerged from hiding. And Gilbertus didn't entirely trust what the robot might do. I wish the humans hadn't made such a mess of things, Erasmus said, simulating a long sigh. The 1,000 years of machine rule were quite efficient and well organized. I fear the galaxy will never be the same. Gilbertus closed the Tyranny of the Demon Robot Erasmus. I don't disagree, but you may be overlooking a key insight. A key insight? Erasmus sounded delighted. Share it with me. It serves no purpose for you to criticize the humans for their rebellion when you yourself were the catalyst. You personally were the direct cause of the downfall of the machine empire. Erasmus sounded offended. How so? I might have inadvertently contributed in some small way by dropping Serena's baby from the tower. In every way, Gilbertus countered. None of the machine defeat would have happened without you. You posed the challenge to Omnius, deciding to question the loyalty of the human slaves who had previously shown no evidence of organized resistance. You suggested that you could trick some of your slave masters into turning against the machines. You planted the hints of a human rebellion. It was an interesting experiment, Erasmus said. And it destroyed the synchronized empire. Without you, Iblis Ginja would never have organized his rebel cells, would never have considered overthrowing the Omnius worlds. When you killed the infant son of Serena Butler by throwing him off a balcony in front of a great crowd, you touched a spark to the tinder that you yourself had laid. An unusual conclusion. Erasmus sounded hesitant, then admitted, when viewed in that light, perhaps I was responsible. Gilbertus stood from his desk. Ponder that, Father, when you're feeling restless and isolated here. If you had been more careful, the Machine Empire would never have fallen. And because you're all that's left, and because I worry about you, I don't intend to be careless. He closed the robot's memory core back in its hidden cabinet, making sure all the locks and seals were in place. Then he went off to instruct his students on how to order their minds more like the thinking machines.
History may remember me with awe, terror, or hatred. I don't care which, so long as I am not forgotten. General Agamemnon, New Memoirs.
Leading a small group of Butlerian hunters, Swordmaster Ellis felt more like a scavenger than a predator. Omnius and his robotic forces had been utterly defeated, and even their deactivated remnants could pose no threat. The rebellious Cymex had also been wiped out, leaving dead walker bodies and obscure empty outposts. But cleanup remained to be done. In the icy ruins of the last Cymex stronghold on Hesra, human investigators had discovered a database compiled by the notorious Titan Juno, records listing the locations of many secret Cymex bases, and Manford had commanded that each one be destroyed before the bases fell into the hands of corruptible humans like Joseph Fenport. Methodically, Ellis and his hunters were going to each set of coordinates in the Hesra records and leaving the machine bases in smoldering ruins. The mission would last for 6 months or longer, and he would be out of contact with Butlerian headquarters, except to submit occasional progress reports. During their years of ruthless physical training on Ganaz, Ellis and Inari Idaho, comrades, rivals, occasional lovers, had been fascinated by the legends of Serena Butler's glorious jihad. Captivated by stories of those heroic days, he and Inari wished they could have been fighting armies of combat robots or ferocious Cymec walkers, but they had been born a century too late. All that remained now was a mop-up operation to eradicate the leftovers, but it was a job that needed to be done. His scout ship arrived at the next location, a cratered, airless rock that barely met the definition of a planet. Robots had no need for an atmosphere, and Cymec brains, protected inside their preservation canisters, could live anywhere. If this system hadn't been noted in the secret Cymec records, no one would have bothered to go there.
Scan closely and keep your eyes open, Ellis said to his Butlerian comrades. Look for artificial structures. There's got to be something here.
Ellis had spent years on Ganaz learning how to fight with a pulse sword against salvaged combat mechs. He and Inari had done well, killing many of their machine opponents and feeling like gladiators in an ancient arena. But it was all for show. The thinking machines had been long defeated. The Swordmaster fantasized about finding a still-functioning base crowded with evil thinking machines, worthy opponents at last for a man of his fighting skills. It would be like turning over a rock and discovering an infestation of tiny black beetles. That, however, was a private thought that he did not dare discuss with anyone, not even dear Inari. Ellis felt driven, but also calmly confident. Each step brought the Butlerians closer to eradicating all vestiges of thinking machines, though no closer to forgetting them. What would they do when there was nothing left? When the thinking machines were completely gone, the movement would lack focus and purpose. If there is no enemy, do we just create a new one? Manford's followers couldn't just go around smashing everything that contained electronics or moving parts. That would be foolish and misguided, and would inevitably force them to shun even the workings of their own spacecraft. The ship cruised over the stark landscape, where distant, unfiltered sunlight cast the crags and canyons into sharp relief. Belus's team members, 6 Butlerians and 2 more swordmasters, peered through the window ports and scanned the surface before erupting into chatter.
"There it is, sir, on the left side of that crater."
"By God and Saint Serena, it looks like the war's already been fought here," said Alon, one of the 2 other swordmasters with the team.
Belus caught a glint of metallic domes and habitation chambers, clearly an outpost or a base. Several of the outpost domes were smashed, and the rocky landscape was pocked with divots and craters surrounded by black starbursts of debris, clearly the result of recent explosions rather than ancient impacts. Mangled Cymec walkers lay strewn about, their crab-like legs smashed and bent. Robot attack ships had crashed on the crater floor.
"This must have occurred during the civil war between the Cymecs and Omnius," Ellis said. "This was a secret Cymec base, and the combat robots fought them here."
He gazed intently at the view below.
"Looks like the 2 sides wiped each other out." "Let's hope they left something for us to trash," Swordmaster Alon said with a chuckle. "Otherwise, this was a long and wasted trip."
"If there's anything left, we'll get rid of it."
Ellis turned to his pilot. "Find a place to land so we can make our way inside." They found the core of the laboratory facility still intact, and the ship managed to dock with an access hatch. The atmosphere inside read as frigid, but surprisingly breathable. The power was still on, and life support systems functioning.
"Everyone, join us inside and assist with the operation," Ellis announced. They would all want their chance.
"They must have conducted experiments with humans here," said Kellion, the 3rd swordmaster, "or they wouldn't have bothered with heat and air.
If we find records inside, maybe we can discover what the Cymecs were doing and what happened during this battle," said one of the Butlerians.
Ellis had not bothered to learn all of their names. He raised his voice, brisk and businesslike.
"Such answers don't concern us. We just have to get rid of this place, for it is inherently dangerous."
He shuddered to think what might happen if some ambitious person, such as Joseph Venport, were to find this site and try to recreate the abominable work of the Cymecs.
Once the entire team crossed over to the outpost, the Butlerians began to move through the chambers, ransacking and destroying. They needed no explicit orders.
Swordmaster Alon discovered experimental logs kept in a set of non-sentient computer databases, but the Butlerians pummeled the machines into wreckage without reading them. Specimens, frozen tissue samples, dissected brains, gel circuitry patterns, and reservoirs of vibrant blue electrofluid filled shelves and storage lockers. The full destruction took hours. Ellis could have bombarded the whole outpost from the hunter ship, but he believed in doing things properly, providing him and his comrades with emotional satisfaction that they could pass on to their superior. Ellis included as many details as he could remember in his reports to Manfred, so that the Butlerian leader could imagine that he had participated. As the destruction continued, Ellis and the other 2 swordmasters made their way to the center of the complex, a nightmarish chamber filled with glistening, forbidden machinery and computer technology. Looking like an intaglio etched in the glass, frost covered the inner window of a thick door that led to a sealed vault. Ellis bent closer, wondering what further horrors the Cymecs might have been working on, and peered through the frost-dusted window into the armored vault. Was there some specific reason the thinking machines had come to eradicate this secret Cymec place? Inside, he saw 2 standing forms, the slender human figures of a man and a woman. The 2 had no wristbands or shackles holding them prisoner. Both were petrified, sheathed in a thin coating of frost. Ellis summoned Alon and Kellion to his side while he studied the chamber controls, trying to determine the most likely way to unseal the door. With only clubs, battering rams, and pry bars, the 3 swordmasters would never get through that massive hatch. Fortunately, even though he knew little about technology, the controls were intuitive, perhaps even willingly cooperative, as if some small demon still lived within the computer system and wanted to cause mischief. In only a few minutes, the vault door hissed open with a gasp of roiling, chemical-scented air. Ellis held his breath for fear the gas might be poison, but it dissipated quickly. A small glow of station lights lit the cold vault without flickering, illuminating the preserved man and woman. They were about 20 years old, trim and perfect in appearance, with dark hair, delicate features, and a line of frost on their eyebrows and lips. Both were naked. Ellis felt disgust, like a heavy weight inside. These poor people. They must have been victims of experiments. Kellyanne said, "Manfred would want us to give them a respectful burial." "The mind of man is holy," Alon intoned. In seeming disagreement with the assessment of their deaths, the young man and woman simultaneously opened their eyes, gray orbs that stared unfocused, then sharpened. The duo shivered, twitched their shoulders, and inhaled a loud, drowning person's breath. With a shout, Ellis rushed to catch the young woman before she could collapse, but she brushed aside the assistance with unexpected strength and went ramrod straight. The young man stepped forward, gave a cobweb-clearing shake of his head. "That was a long time waiting. Has it been decades? Or centuries?" "We've released you now. You're safe," Ellis said. "Who are you?" The young woman spoke up.
"I am Hyla. And this is my twin, Andros."
"Are we free now?" the man asked. The swordmasters led them out of the cold chamber.
"Yes, you're free."
"We saved you," Ellis said. Kellyanne added,
"Omnius and the thinking machines are no more. The Cymex have all been destroyed, every last one of them. We were victorious. You are safe. Your long nightmare is over."
The twins looked at each other, cocking their heads to listen. In other chambers of the complex, Ellis could hear wanton smashing as the Butlerians destroyed the machinery, the computers. "Fortunately, we found you in time," Ellis said. "We will soon finish demolishing this base." Andros's eyes narrowed and his face went tight.
"They shouldn't be doing that." "We travel to every known machine base and erase all vestiges of the Cymec Reign of Terror," said Swordmaster Alon. "That is our mission. Once we grind everything under our heels, those dark memories will never bother us again."
A ripple of rage swept like a dust storm across the strange young man's face. His skin flickered, the pale flesh tone taking on a metallic cast, as if mercury flowed just beneath the skin. Andros flattened his hand, which became as rigid as steel, and he slashed sideways in an effortless karate chop that cleanly decapitated the swordmaster. Even before blood could spurt from the stump of Alon's neck, the young woman sprang into motion. Hyla shoved her fist through Kellyanne's chest, crushing his sternum and pushing all the way through his spine. Swordmaster Ellis had just enough time to bring up his sword, and Hyla parried the blade with her armored skin forearm. A metallic sound rang out, and the unexpected jarring nearly dislocated Ellis's arm. He had fought against the most sophisticated combat mechs on Ganaz. His sensei instructor had challenged him with the highest and fastest settings in the battle robot's memory. But none of that had prepared him for these twins. The young woman grasped Ellis's sword with both hands and snapped the blade in half, then struck a hard blow on the base of his neck, crushing his spine and paralyzing him. The last swordmaster dropped to the floor, still awake, still aware. Three flushed and giddy Butlerians entered the room just as Ellis fell. Grinning, Andros leaped forward and began tearing them limb from limb. Hyla stood over the paralyzed Ellis, gazing down at him, her face young, beautiful, and inhuman. The swordmaster heard screams as her brother finished murdering the three Butlerians in the chamber, then bounded down the connecting passages to hunt the rest of them. None of those people stood a chance. Hyla leaned closer to Ellis and said,
"We are the children of Agamemnon. My brother and I have been awake here for decades with nothing to do but wonder and question and wait. Now, before I finish killing you, tell me exactly what has happened in the intervening years. We need to know."
The swordmaster clamped his mouth shut. In the adjoining module, another set of horrified screams rang out, echoing off the curved metal walls.
"Tell me."
Hyla bent down, extended a forefinger, and began to toy with his eye.
Slavery can take many forms. Some are overt, while others are discreet. All are reprehensible. Vorian Atreides, The Legacy Journals, Kepler Period. The slave markets on Poratrin covered a vast area of the muddy and humid Isana River Plain. Vorian felt discouraged to see the clutter of ships landing and departing, the burgeoning crowds in the marketplace. Locating one group of captives in all this would be nearly impossible. Yet he had led the generations-long fight against Omnius, and the human race had won, beating all odds. Yes, he would find his people. But it was going to take some effort. Poratrin had long engaged in the buying and selling of slaves. During the crusade against the thinking machines, many planetary populations had refused to join the fight, hiding from the most important battle mankind had ever faced. For that reason, other humans had felt justified in forcing the pacifists to work for the greater good. Now, however, the jihad was over and the thinking machines defeated. As Vor walked among the jostling people, he could no longer imagine any rationale for slavery. But the practice continued anyway. Too much money and power was involved in the operations, and some of Imperial society still depended on these slave markets. Morally obsolete, but still profitable. He knew, however, that a new justification had developed as an unexpected side effect of the anti-technology fervor. With many planets naively abandoning sophisticated machinery in the wake of the growing Butlerian movement, they required a large labor pool to do the work. To some people, he supposed, slaves were more palatable than machines. Vor had been to many planets in his life, more than he could remember offhand. In his early years, he had accompanied the robot Surratt all across the synchronized worlds in an update ship, delivering copies of the Omnius Evermind. Once he switched his loyalties to the League worlds, he had fought the thinking machines on planet after planet for more than a century. Here on Poratrin, he had carried out an ambitious scheme of building a gigantic fleet of foe warships, a massive bluff that had intimidated the Omnius fleet, a wonderfully successful trick. He hadn't been to Poratrin in many, many years. As a sideshow in the middle of Serena Butler's jihad, a massive slave uprising on this planet had wrought great devastation. A pseudo-atomic explosion annihilated much of the city of Starda and killed the legendary scientist T.O. Holtzman, a great blow to humanity's defenses. But the explosion had merely cleared a crowded section of town. The lowlands were now paved over, the ground fused, the pooling waters constrained with rigid canals. A kaleidoscope of temporary structures crowded the open areas where slavers brought their cargoes, offered them for sale, then took down the tents and flew away as new flesh merchants swooped in to grab the open space. Catering to them, vendors offered lodging, food, drugs, massage services, prostitutes, and moneylending. In a sad way, he realized that not much had changed. Keeping his eyes open and forming a plan for his search, Vor found himself swallowed in a stew of humanity as he moved through New Starda, absorbing the size and structure of the place. He was surrounded by grit and odors and city noises, and just walking along the streets and alleys felt like making his way through a pitched battle against combat mechs. Vor longed for the quiet and peace of isolated Kepler, hunting gornet birds in the hills. Now he had to hunt for his family, friends, and neighbors, and bring them home. They were captives here, surely still alive because dead slaves had no value. He needed to find them quickly before they were split up and sold off to dozens of different buyers. He would free them at whatever cost, take them back with him, and find some way to protect the world he had adopted as his own for the past half century. During his flight from Kepler, recalling all the photos Mariella had spread around in their home, Vor had painstakingly assembled a list of his sons and daughters, his adult grandchildren, their spouses, the neighbors, the fellow farmers in the valley, missing friends, anyone he could remember. He had to make certain he left no one behind. As he walked through the slave market, he found a roly-poly slave vendor setting up a stand. When Vor showed him the list of names, the man pursed his lips, looked at him in surprise.
Your first mistake, sir, is thinking that we keep track of individual names. The items offered for sale are not individuals with separate identities. They are mere tools to do a task.
He raised his eyebrows.
Would you name a pry bar or a hammer?
Remembering how Xavier Harkonnen would have laid out a detailed battle plan, Vor next went to a Poratrin tourism office, where guides advertised tours of the canyons upriver or zeppelin flights over the open plains. He expected the government-sponsored office to know the layout of the slave markets, perhaps offering a map or guide, but the smiling official was no help at all. Vorian Atreides made further inquiries and paid bribes. Over the centuries, he had amassed quite a fortune, now dispersed in various far-flung accounts around the Imperium. The wealth meant little to him, since he had everything he needed and did not live an extravagant lifestyle. Fortunately, the new banking system offered by Venhold linked those accounts, so Vor had access to his funds. He could be generous with his inducements, but simple questions raised too many questions of their own. Despite his increasing sense of urgency, haunted by the faces of all the people he had lived with on Kepler, the social tapestry that had made his life feel so complete, he decided to take a different tack, thinking like a businessman rather than an aggrieved party. Vorian Atreides had deceived entire armies of thinking machines. He could certainly outwit a few slavers. Among the crowded stalls, the tall, dark-haired man spoke to one of the Dragoon police guards who patrolled the markets.
I'm willing to pay for solid, verified information. I have a large construction project in a particularly hot and humid area of my planet. Surely you keep track of where the slaves come from. I don't want to buy a workforce from a cold world or an arid one. I've done my research and I need people accustomed to the climate or I'll lose half of my workers in a week.
The guard pursed his lips.
I take your meaning, sir. New Starda is in the process of instituting records to help match certain kinds of slaves to compatible environments. Alas, the formal system is caught up in committee right now and not readily available.
He shrugged. Vor recognized the tantalizing hint and hesitation as a subtle request for a bribe. So he offered money, and the Dragoon scratched the side of his face, as if thinking through the problem, although he already had a solution.
I know a woman in Spaceport Administration who has access to landing and cargo records. Such information is not normally open to inspection, but if you give her my name and pay her a discretionary fee, she will let you inspect the records of all slaving ships that have arrived recently.
Vor maintained his cool expression, though his pulse began to race. He had seen the three slaving ships that preyed upon Kepler. Hopefully he would find them in the documentation. The Dragoon pocketed his payment with a deft movement.
It may require some homework on your part, but maybe you can look at the source planet information and find workers to your liking.
At the spaceport, Vor had to pay three more bribes just to find the woman he was supposed to meet, then another large sum to gain access to the landing records. The money didn't matter. He would pay whatever was necessary. In his brash earlier years, he and Xavier might have tried to coerce the information, fighting for justice. But this method was, ironically, more civilized, though more expensive. He couldn't overthrow an entire world or a long-standing way of life. Seeing the long lists of human cargo tore at his heart. All those captives had been torn from their homes on hundreds of poorly defended planets, leaving behind families who were just as distraught as he was. But Vorian